You're listening to Plague Talk, the podcast that owes its existence to COVID-19, where, because we suddenly have a lot more time on our hands and worry on our minds, we talk with anybody who dares about the old normal, the new normal, strategies, epiphanies, hopes, and fears, and what we want normal to look like when and if it's all over. Because who says we have to go back to all the things that were broken and wrong before? Our guest is Dr. Amish Adalja. Dr. Adalja is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. His work is focused on emerging infectious diseases, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. He has helped develop U.S. guidelines for the treatment of plague, botulism, and anthrax, served as an external advisor to the New York City Health and Hospital Emergency Management Highly Infectious Disease Training Program, and on a FEMA working group on nuclear disaster recovery. Dr. Adalja is an associate editor of the journal Health Security, was a co-editor of Global Catastrophic Biological Risks, and a contributing author for the Handbook of Bioterrorism and Disaster Medicine, among other publications. He has published in such journals as the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of Infectious Diseases, Clinical Infectious Diseases, Emerging Infectious Diseases, and the Annals of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Adalja is a fellow of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the American College of Physicians, and the American College of Emergency Physicians. He's a member of the American Medical Association, the HIV Medicine Association, and the Society of Critical Care Medicine. Dr. Adalja is a native of Butler, Pennsylvania, and actively practices infectious disease, critical care, and emergency medicine in the Pittsburgh metropolitan area, where he also serves on the City of Pittsburgh's HIV Commission and on the advisory group of AIDS-Free Pittsburgh. Dr. Amish Adalja, you're an infectious diseases expert with a focus on pandemic preparedness, emerging infectious diseases, and emergency medicine, whose expertise has been featured on NPR, in articles by The New Yorker, The New York Times, and regularly on cable news networks such as MSNBC and Fox News, and have gone deep into the mechanics of pandemics and of the novel coronavirus in particular on smart podcasts with large followings like Sam Harris's Making Sense, which is how you first came to my attention, and On the Drive with Peter Attia. So I am deeply honored that you were willing to pry yourself from what must be an exhausting and very busy schedule to donate some of what must be your very scarce time to a thing with a name as silly as Plague Talk. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I will link this episode to some of your other podcasts and news interviews so my listeners can catch up on what you've had to say so far so I don't have you just repeating yourself. You've been intensively studying emerging infectious diseases, thinking about and helping to craft pandemic preparedness for, is this correct, at least a decade?
Yes, yeah, about 12 years or so, at least.
Okay, and have said that you followed the progression of these things with the fervor of a sports enthusiast following their favorite team. What drew you, and at what age, to your chosen specialization or specializations, and what about it continues to elicit that enthusiasm?
So there are two kind of origin stories for how I got interested in this. One is that both my parents are physicians, and one of my favorite books as a child was the story of Louis Pasteur. Mm-hmm. It's called The Value of Believing in Yourself, and it tells the story of how he developed the rabies vaccine, which was the second human vaccine. And I was fascinated with that as a child and read it over and over again and had memorized the book, knowing exactly when the pages need to be turned. And wow. That was something that really stuck with me, that whole idea of discovery and detective work and thinking about infectious diseases as something that reaches into people's lives in a way that's very different than many other fields of medicine because of all of the other implications. So even just thinking about rabies, the fact that it involved an animal species, that you had to understand what a person was exposed to, that got me really interested in it. But I didn't initially want to specifically go into medicine. And then I dabbled a little bit in finance, but I had taken enough classes that I could easily pivot pretty quickly. And when I decided that I wanted to go into medicine, it wasn't a question to me that I would not do infectious disease. That was something that was a foregone conclusion because that was the part of medicine that was the most fascinating to me. And it really comes back to the detective work. The fact that you've got to figure out, how did this person come into contact with this microorganism? What did they do? What habits did they have? And that's something different than many parts of medicine. And the fact is, and we're living in it right now, infectious diseases have a cascading impact unlike any other field of medicine. You're not going to have economic shutdowns or national security threatened or major politicization of any other thing to the scale that you do with infectious disease. So right. To be in infectious disease, you really touch everything in the world, all of human knowledge. And I think that's what's something that I really relish about it.
You're involved in the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins University. What is the mission of the CHS and what is your role in that think tank?
So I'm a senior scholar at that think tank, and I've been with that think tank since I was an infectious disease fellow, so early on in my training. And the Center for Health Security was initially called the Center for Biosecurity, and its mission was to make the country more resilient to infectious disease emergency. Initially, it was founded in response to the threat of bioterrorism, and it was founded by the man who eradicated smallpox, D.A. Henderson. And it sort of has expanded its footprint from just being mainly concerned about bioterrorism and biological weapons to thinking about the whole host of infectious disease and health security threats. And we work to try and improve the systems that we have in the United States and around the world to detect these types of events, as well as trying to build the capacity in hospitals, educate policymakers, educate the public about the importance of infectious disease resiliency. And we do a lot of different projects around these themes, and probably are the only think tank that is solely focused on this topic.
Yeah, and it makes sense that you would expand the purview to include just infectious diseases, not as acts of bioterrorism, because as you said, the cascading effects could be tantamount to any given bioterrorist effect if we're not prepared and resilient.
Exactly. So an infectious disease, whether it's intentional or non-intentional, ends up having the same type of cascading effect that you're going to have the same type of preparations, the same types of systems in place, whether it's a man-made pandemic or one that is natural.
Yeah, wow. You've said that we learn new things about the novel coronavirus every day. What are some of the most recent findings in terms of symptoms and enhanced susceptibilities as with pre-existing conditions or prior illnesses that we know about?
Well, we're learning that this has a range of symptoms that can range from the very mild cold-like symptoms that many other coronaviruses cause to severe manifestations, including strokes in younger individuals, blood clotting disorders, apparent low levels of blood oxygen where a person is compensated enough that they don't actually look as sick as you would expect them with low levels of blood oxygen to look. We've learned about an inflammatory syndrome that can occur in rare circumstances in children that mimics Kawasaki syndrome, which is a scary autoimmune disorder. To me, what I think is really interesting is trying to understand how this virus has made its way around the world. And we're learning more and more every day about when this virus appeared in the United States and how long it had been spreading before anyone took notice of it, when people had their eyes on China and other countries themselves were starting to have community level spread. And it's becoming clear that we had community level spread as early as January going on. And that really argues against some of the initial policies that were put into place that were very focused on a travel related infection when it was already here. And I think that's going to be fascinating, is unraveling the first days of this virus in the United States and where it took hold and how it took hold.
Yes, because of how that might help us prevent it or place some kind of checkpoints for future incident.
Yeah, I think I do think that it will be something that's important. And it really reinforces what many of us were saying in the very early stages, that when we realized that this was a community spreading respiratory virus that had been present in China since at least mid-November, there was no telling what other places in the world it had gotten to.
Yeah. This Kawasaki disease, like multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children that you mentioned, as far as I've heard, has only been estimated to have impacted 300 U.S. children, and happens when the antibodies are present, but the active coronavirus no longer is present. Is it rare enough that we can consider it an outlier at this point, and the most children who get infected with coronavirus won't develop this MISC?
I do think it is an outlier. It is a rare complication that's likely related to the coronavirus. It doesn't change the overall advice that you give parents regarding children getting infected, that most children do very, very well with this. It's not anything that really even sets them back. However, there are some small percentage that can develop this inflammatory syndrome, and we're trying to understand what the risk factors are for it and why it occurs in certain individuals and not in certain individuals, why it occurred in certain countries but not in other countries. There's a lot of mystery to it, but it is something that doesn't characterize how the average child does with this virus, which is very, very well.
Yes, indeed. And what are some of the countries in which it has not appeared?
Well, it hasn't really appeared in the Asian countries as much as it has in United States and European countries. And I think that's interesting because Kawasaki syndrome, which is very similar to this, does appear more frequently at baseline in Asian countries. So I think this is another interesting mystery about this virus and these after effects that it can cause that we really need to understand better.
Yeah, there still are some glaring mysteries to it. Most of the children who've had this MISC appeared healthy and normal, other than having a persistent fever when they arrived at the hospital. What symptoms should parents monitor, and at what point should they take their child to a hospital?
Well, this syndrome has multiple symptoms. One of them is unremitting fever, and those fevers tend to be high. Some children will develop a rash. Some children will develop abdominal pain. That's what you need to look for. And some of that may be just kind of what you would do anyway, even if you didn't know about the coronavirus, if your child had an unremitting fever or had severe abdominal pain or developed an odd-looking rash, that you would prompt them to go seek help. So any of those symptoms are a trigger for thinking about this infection, even if they may not have had a respiratory infection that you can think about, or maybe it was in the remote past. Until we at least get a better handle on understanding what's behind this, it is going to be something that parents are going to have to be alert for.
I've heard that one great hope for a treatment with a big effect size are monoclonals derived from people who survived COVID-19. Can you explain what monoclonals are, how they're applied, and how effective they might prove to be?
Sure. So monoclonal antibodies are basically synthetic antibodies that are based on the antibodies that form after somebody has been infected. So once you get infected, your body's going to make antibodies, and some of those antibodies are going to be stronger than others. And what a monoclonal antibody does is it basically takes the best cocktail of those antibodies, or maybe just a single antibody, and makes it into a drug that you can administer people. And this has seen great success in treating infectious diseases like Ebola.
Wow.
And that is a hope, that we will have a monoclonal antibody against this novel coronavirus that may help individuals from becoming severely ill. It may help those that are severely ill to recover faster. And it would be an important addition to the tools that we're using to fight this virus. But it is something that will take some time to develop. And there are efforts underway to make a monoclonal antibody. And right now, what we're hearing about are trials using convalescent plasma. So that's individuals who have recovered, just taking their blood, which contains many antibodies, some of which are going to be really effective, some of which may not be that effective, in transfusing those.
Right. So you're maximizing that effect. You're taking the best of the most effective antibodies and cloning those.
Right.
That's incredible. You've said something to the effect of, if one has been sheltering at home and has no link to the virus as far as they know, there's no hard scientific protocol to follow for an absolute time frame as to when they can safely visit loved ones again. Can you give us some guidelines for assessing the risks and for minimizing the risk-to-benefit ratio of visits, say, to elderly parents or grandparents?
What I think needs to be understood by the general public is the fact that this virus is not going to change biologically. It's going to be present with us, and it is going to be a risk we have to think about until there is a vaccine. That social distancing mandates that came from government were more about preserving hospital capacity and slowing the pace of cases down so that they were more manageable by hospitals and health departments who were doing contact tracing. Now that that's largely been solved in many parts of the country, it has now fallen to individuals to decide what level of risk tolerance is appropriate for them. And that's going to be something that's not going to be one size fits all. There's not going to be black or white answers. It's going to be lots of shades of gray. And people are going to really have to think about what's essential in their life, what's not essential in their life, what their values are, and make decisions about what risk they want to take. Because every time we step out the door, this virus is going to be a threat that we have to think about until there is a vaccine. And that's something that Americans really haven't had to deal with for at least 100 years or so. So the general principles are really going to be, are you someone that's at high risk for complications? Are you elderly? Do you have other medical conditions? Or are you around those types of individuals? And how easy can it be for you to social distance at whatever activity you're doing? All of that's going to kind of factor in how you kind of approach this. And there are going to be people that have a high risk tolerance, and it's not going to be really constraining. But there are going to be others who are very risk averse, and that they're going to feel still constrained until they have a vaccine. And I would say that in general, the only general principle that you can actually say is, if you are sick, if you have symptoms consistent with the coronavirus, you definitely shouldn't be around other people. But if you don't have symptoms, then it really is going to be something that's going to be hard for a doctor to prescribe what you do. Obviously, you can help people make decisions about their social interactions. If they're an immunosuppressed person or a transplant patient or somebody that's very frail or sick, they should be really trying to avoid contact with others until there is a vaccine. But for anybody kind of short of those extreme situations, it is going to be something that there's just not going to be a straight guidance on. It's going to really be determined on an individual level. And I think that's going to be difficult for people.
And I've even thought if people do assess that they are, and the people they're visiting are not at risk of contaminating each other, that before they go, they should sort of use the Jim Brown method. Jim Brown was a footballer who would, in the locker room, try to imagine every possible scenario that could happen on the field and strategize against it, so that they can imagine if they're going to visit a grandparent who is doting but also forgetful, to know that they're probably at some point going to step forward for a hug or something like that. And so prepare for the best way to gently handle that situation, but effectively handle it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult because, you know, you don't want to be in the position of saying that you cannot hug anybody for 2 years. I don't think that's feasible or realistic because right. Life is going to go on. And I think people have forgotten that because you get questions like, well, I'm not going to hug anybody this week, but next week I'm going to start doing that or something like that. It's the equivalent of that. And there's nothing going to change in 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now or 3 months from now. We're still going to be facing this virus. So I think that people had thought that social distancing was going to make this virus go away and that all our problems are going to be solved. But no, now it's the hard part is trying to find a middle path, trying to learn how to modify your activities to live with this virus and minimize the risk of harm. You suffer from this virus or others suffer from this virus, but at the same time, being able to live your life, pursue your values and go on. And I think that's something that's going to be very difficult for a lot of people to try and balance.
Right. Minimize the risk, but maximize the satisfaction of just human interaction.
Right. And it's going to be different for each person. I mean, some people are not going to, are going to basically go back to their baseline, and some people won't be able to go back to their baseline because they're at high risk. And we're going to have this kind of heterogeneous way of dealing with this virus until we have a vaccine.
Yeah. I'm sorry to ask you what is, I know, a question that you've had to answer many times, but what's your best ETA now for our having a vaccine against the novel coronavirus?
I think it will probably be possible within 2 years to have enough to vaccinate a good proportion of the population. You have to remember that vaccine development is something that is measured in years, not in months. And yes. Even when you look at the 12 to 18 month timescale or even shorter timescales, using all the great technologies that are available now, I do think everything would have to go perfect for that to happen. It's in the realm of possibility, but I don't think that we should wed ourselves to a specific date on when we think the vaccine will be available. You have to remember this has to be made on an industrial scale, over 300 million doses for just this country. And these technologies, as fast as and as great as they are, they are a little bit untried, and we're going to have to make sure that we do the appropriate efficacy and safety trials so that we know how well these things work. And I think that it is great that we're moving as fast as we are, but I don't want to overpromise that we'll have a vaccine before the end of the year like some people have done, because I don't know if that's actually going to happen, and I don't want people to get a false sense of security.
You've often cautioned against panic and warned that the effects of panic would make our situation much worse. Can you give us an idea of in what ways panic would have a steroidal effect on
pandemic? Well, what happens is it's often policymakers and the public's reaction to a virus that magnifies the impact of the virus itself. And I think we've seen that from the very start with this pandemic. For example, with travel bans and panic buying, where you had toilet paper shortages and mask buying, and all of that really comes from panic. Mm-hmm, and then that panic can then morph into conspiracy theories that where people don't trust anything that they're being told. And that's made it much harder to actually be someone that's an infectious disease expert or a public health authority and trying to speak to the general public. So I do think that panic has been something that we've been fighting the entire time during this pandemic. And this is very normal to happen. It's just that it's much more accelerated in an era when you have social media and 24-hour news stations where this is all people are talking about. And what you find is that panic and the way people react to each other and to policymakers, to public health authorities, just has this way of being an extraneous thing that you're always fighting against during an emergency situation.
Yeah, as soon as I hear, one of the ways that I tamp my own tendency toward panic or hyperbole is as soon as I hear a politician or any other newscaster say, "I'm not a scientist, but," and launch into their opinion, immediately my noise to signal ratio detector starts to buzz. And I don't listen as much to what they say as I go to source material, source people, and try to see what they have to say.
Yeah, this outbreak has definitely caused that to happen a lot more because it's touched everybody in a way that most other infectious disease emergencies haven't. So this has led to a whole army of armchair epidemiologists, armchair pharmacologists, all kinds of different cottage industries are popping up because of this this outbreak being such a major disruptive event on everyone's lives. And it's made it much harder for people to sort through what actually is valid and what is actually not.
Instant internet epidemiologist just add virus, yeah. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because you've led into this political partisan polarity in the United States has reached the point where anything that can be spun to have importance or even identity relevance to either party will reliably become almost reliably become a wedge issue. For example, the current battle between the left and the right over the value of human life versus that of economic health is a false dichotomy. Those two things clearly do not exist in isolation from one another and are, in fact, inextricably interdependent. So we have got to become level-headed and adult enough to face the fact that in a capitalist system, which, love it or not, is what we have, the physical health of from tens to hundreds of millions of citizens is predicated upon a healthy and functional, if not robust and growing, economy, and vice versa. So we can't have thriving businesses with an exponentially more infected and afflicted workforce, and loss of jobs means loss of health insurance for employees and their families, loss of small businesses at a time when bigger businesses are at best in a hiring freeze can lead to even loss of homes, increased exposure to COVID-19, and vaster numbers, and therefore a more likely healthcare system's overwhelmed, and on into a dystopian nightmare scenario. So there has to come a time, and probably sooner than later, when those whose jobs can't be performed remotely must return to their places of employment. And for that to have the desired and not more disastrous outcomes, reopening must be orchestrated in an informed, intelligent, and phased way. How much longer do you think, or do voices at the Center for Health Security also think, that we can pause without the economic fallout significantly leading to worse national health and security margins? And what is your thinking about the timeline for and safest ways for us to reopen commercial pathways and return to work?
So it's important to know that at the Center for Health Security, in my field in general, there are varied opinions. Not everybody has the exact same view on all of this. And it is something that is very difficult to strike the right balance. And what I would say is that, you know, any pause is going to be deleterious. And the fact that we ended up with economic shutdowns as the only blunt tool that governors had is the fault of the fact that we fumbled so badly in the early stages of this outbreak. We talked about how early on this was spreading in January in the United States, unbeknownst to anybody, while we kind of dawdled at a federal level in terms of scaling up testing, preparing hospitals, public health messaging, getting our health department's resource to do massive contact tracing. All of January, all of February, most of March, basically wasted. So by the time that this virus had bubbled over to these chains of transmissions that were putting hospitals in New York City into crisis, there was nothing left but economic shutdowns. But it didn't have to be that way.
Yes.
And we know that it is a false alternative, that the economy is people's lives, because in order to live, you have to be productive. You have to be able to produce. And people, if you pause that for so long of a period, people are not going to be able to live. And it becomes very hard to decide exactly how long to do that and when to do it and how blanket to be. And I do think that for places like New York City, there needed to be some drastic action taken before those hospitals went into crisis. For other parts of the country, I think it was variable and could have been done in a more nuanced and precision-guided manner, because we already know that one state, you know, we've already seen examples where just across a state border, construction was permitted in one state, not in another state. Lots of different variations between states that didn't necessarily derive from any kind of scientific principle. So that I think is important.
Right.
But as we think about social distancing for an infectious disease like this, the metric that I use the most is hospital capacity, because that's where I think that's the only thing that really we worry about here, because this is a virus that's endemic now in the human population. It's not going anywhere. So the only metric that you can look at, to me, is hospital capacity, making sure as you remove social distancing regulations, you keep an eye to the hospital to make sure that it's okay in terms of personal protective equipment, mechanical ventilators, ICU bed space, staffing. And the same is true for your health department. Are there case contact investigators becoming inundated? And then you kind of move forward that way. And that's the best way to do it. I don't think we had to have been as drastic as we were in many of the states. I definitely think places like New York were unique, and what happened in New York City wasn't necessarily extrapolable to the rest of the country. But I do think that we have to be on the alert for hospital capacity issues anywhere. And we're already hearing about hospital capacity threatened in places like Montgomery, Alabama, and the Twin Cities in Minnesota as well.
And you've said before, it's also important that these hospitals build relationships with other smaller satellite hospitals or hospitals that might not even have a prior relationship to that hospital in case of the need for overflow, to delegate patients from one to another.
Exactly. A theme that we've been at my center talking about for a long time is preparing healthcare systems for disasters, for infectious disease emergencies, will often require not just them acting kind of in isolation, but being part of a healthcare coalition where they can pool resources, share situational awareness about what's going on, and really have a way to come up with a system of care during an emergency. And I think that that's one way to help offload some of the capacity issues that could occur in a small hospital. When they're able to lean on other partners.
Thank you. You know, I've got so many other things that I want to ask you, but I did solicit some questions from Facebook friends and would like to ask you some of those if I might while we still have a few minutes. One from Nils King Hammer: how vulnerable is the virus, and to what conditions and substances, when outside of a host organism, what kills it, and is there an official inactivation temperature?
This is a very fragile virus, and most viruses are pretty fragile. The ones that aren't are very notable things like norovirus, for example, which causes cruise ship outbreaks. This virus has kind of this envelope around it made of fatty types of molecules, and they dry out pretty quickly. So this isn't something that lives or is viable outside of a human host or any host for a long period of time, and it is exquisitely susceptible to any household detergent or soap that you might use. It disrupts the virus pretty easily. So it's not so much an issue on surfaces. And actually now you've seen the CDC recognize this and downgrade surface transmission as a less important means of transmission than person to person.
Yes.
There is a temperature of inactivation. I don't know it off the top of my head, but the proteins that make up the virus, all of those things can be denatured at a certain temperature. But I would say even cooking temperature would be enough to disrupt the virus.
Thank you. I'm going to bring up Jerry Weil's question because it's a two-parter. I'd like to get the whole mortality rate issue cleared up. There's a drastic difference between mortality from known cases and estimated cases. Going back to the Spanish flu, we see an estimated 500 million cases with 50 million deaths. That would come to a 10% mortality rate, yet the mortality rate is listed as 2%, which is it no longer is. If the number of deaths is anywhere near accurate, that means that nearly twice the number of people who existed on the planet would have had to have been infected, which is impossible. Can they clear all those numbers up? So I thought I could nip this in the bud by pointing Jerry to your answer on the Drive podcast when you were talking about the 3.7 to 6 tenths of a percentage figure. His response to that was, see, this brings up more confusion. Dr. Adalja says he's giving numbers for the case fatality rate, but then what he describes is actually the infection fatality rate, which is typically much lower. If he's basing it on antibody tests, that would be the IFR from my understanding, because that includes asymptomatic people as well. I thought CFR would only include people who showed symptoms, and I really don't understand where the Spanish flu number comes from when, as I stated, the published numbers are 50 million deaths and 500 million infected, a third of the Earth's population at that time.
So that's a hard question. I'll try to explain as much as I can. So going back to the Spanish influenza first, we often quote that 1% fatality rate. And I think I'm not going to draw distinctions between case fatality rate and infection fatality rate for the 1918 flu. And that's based on the best estimates, the 1-2%. And sometimes the numbers at that point from that era are not going to be quite as rigorous as the numbers. That's the best estimate that we have. And it's very hard to get good data from the 1918 era in terms of cause of death. I think that the 1-2%, it makes sense accurately for what we've seen with these types of flu viruses, especially when they can get severe. And I do think that there is not the same type of rigor from 1918. So that's what I would kind of caveat that. There is a difference between case fatality ratios and infection fatality ratios. And when I talk, I sometimes sloppily put them together, because in my mind, I think about everybody being infected as a case, because that's just my mode of thinking. But when I talk about the lower infection rate, the lower rates, where I think it may be 0.5, 0.6, what I'm talking about there is an infection fatality rate, not what the questioner is calling a case fatality rate, because I'm looking at what I think the total denominator of infections are. And obviously, if you're coming to the hospital, you are going to have an increased severity, and your fatality ratio is going to be higher than somebody that's not infected. So that's what I'm talking about. But I do think it is probably the infection fatality rate that's important. And what I think is also important is not necessarily the fatality rate, but the hospitalization rate. And I think that's really something where a lot of the numbers got muddled, where individuals were looking and saying, oh, 20% of these people are getting admitted, but that's 20% of the people that actually come to the hospital, which is very different than 20% of all cases getting admitted, when it's more like 5%. But the problem was that many modelers, especially modelers that were doing stuff for local hospitals, were modeling a 20% hospitalization rate based on maybe a 60% attack rate in their community. And they were coming up with really, really big numbers and getting very nervous about their hospital capacity. And it's clear that many of the models were overestimating the hospitalization rate, most likely because they were looking at a rate that was based upon someone coming to the emergency department than the total denominator of people that were infected and what percentage of those got hospitalized. So that's why I'm much more sensitive to using IFRs versus CFRs.
And it must be much harder to come by the IFR.
Right.
Okay. Lindsay Page Garfield, there is talk of a new strain. Can the doctor shed some light on those findings, if they're true, and what they might mean for the anticipated timeline of this new normal quarantined life?
It's important to remember that all viruses mutate. Coronaviruses in general, though, are one of the viruses that mutate much less because they have a proofreading mechanism in the way they copy, they're copied in the body. And there are different strains of this virus, meaning different lineages. We know that there are lineages that originated from Asia and lineages that have branched off and come from Europe. But that doesn't change anything about the function of the virus. None of these mutations or these lineages are behaving any differently. So I don't think that these other strains make any major difference, because they're all still part of the same strain. It's not like they've changed behavior. That's what we would worry about. It's important to track these strains and to make sure that there are none of those changes accruing. But right now, there's no evidence that this has diverged in a functional way or in a way that makes any difference to the individual being infected, or to our vaccine strategy, or to our antiviral strategy.
Right. So the antiviral, the treatment, and the vaccine strategies would still work against it. It's related enough. One last question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay. Nancy Mosser Bailey, I would love to know, when the government reports the number of cases of COVID-19, does that mean all are symptomatic, or does that mean that they have tested positive for the virus, whether they have symptoms or not? In other words, what's the difference between the word case and the words tested positive? Thanks.
When the government reports cases, those cases are whether they're symptomatic or asymptomatic. So they're all bundled together.
Good. Dr. Adalja, thank you. Is there anything that you wish I had asked that you would like to expound upon?
No, I think we covered a lot of the main topics. I think it's just important to remember that this is now a new virus that's established itself in the human population. And we are going to have to come up with a means to live with it. And I think that's going to be a challenge, because most Americans aren't used to incorporating this type of risk into their daily routine. But that's what we're going to have to do until there's a vaccine.
Thank you. How can people follow you? How can people stay abreast of what you're up to?
The best way is to follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @AmishAA, so AmishAA.
Dr. Amish Adalja, I thank you so much for your time and for being on Plague Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to be a guest on Plague Talk, or you know somebody who would be a great interview, please contact me through email at jack@PlagueTalkPodcast.com, or through the Facebook Plague Talk page, or by using the contract form at PlagueTalkPodcast.com. Send pictures of yourself in the lockdown gallery in your work-at-home spaces, and of your fun and joyful moments. If you have ideas for safe and responsible services for those sheltering in place, please post them to our Facebook page or email them to me. And if you know of links to critical helplines, services, support groups, and resources, we'd love to add them to our Smart Links page. Finally, if you can think of anybody you know who's out there sheltering at home alone, please find it in your heart and now more leisurely schedule to reach out and let them know you're thinking about them. Until next time, stay safe. Keep your distance, don't touch your mask or face, wash those hands, and stay at home, but let the world hear your voice. You've got something to say, we want to hear it.
Plague Talk is a brainchild of Smarty Pod. Theme music by Kiyoshi Fujioka.